It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, take a journey through the worlds of science fiction and fantasy and the world of pop culture that's grown up around them. First, think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the general psychology program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning, and he's co-author, along with John Dunlowski, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth-busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style, and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this, Regan. What does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences and matching a teacher and student's learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, oh, I am a insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. Like, and maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often we will, it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may think we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook or, you know, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember you imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at high school or college or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you. If you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were. If you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I never have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it, and I always thought, I can do that, I could do that, and I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class. And then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form. And then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school. And then in the end of the week, on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them. And then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and, you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. No wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way, or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive. Writing is active. We work with journals. We wrote every day. In fact, when the head of the English department did
I think I got you, Bill. Got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with a subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
And I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more, you know. And that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner, and when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song, and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words. I would sing her history facts, and now she works with a girl that has autism, and when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song, and she has time to put on deodorant, and the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it, and oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just a word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. Back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. So what experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s. And at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away. But she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you're on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just a class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go, because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, you know, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, explore the worlds of pop culture with the author of the book Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you consider yourself a nerd? Maybe you're a big superhero comic fan, or you love to geek out to Harry Potter fan fiction. Our next guest loves a wide variety of what we could call nerd culture, and she says it deserves the same level of cultural analysis and criticism that we usually think about for things that are, you know, more highbrow, a fancy art house film or prestige television. She shares that love in a new book, along with a look at how nerd culture takes on things like race, sexuality, and mental health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you nerd out about? What are those movies, books, TV shows, comics, you name it, mean to you or add to your life? Do you feel like you're part of a community, a fandom for some particular pop culture? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Phillips is a poet, author, and critic at large for the New York Times. Her new book is Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. She's appearing at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow at 9 p.m. at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Can you share your origin story a little bit? Where did you first start to love nerd culture?
Oh my gosh. It has always been a part of my life. I don't even know. I mean, even from when I was a child, from a very young child, I remember I was just watching like early anime. Like I remember I watched Speed Racer when I was still in diapers. Like I was watching early anime from elementary school. I was watching Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon, and I was into Harry Potter when it came. You know, it has always been a part of my identity. And I just, it's interesting to see how it's become so mainstream now.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but I want to get into this idea. I think this is really central to a lot of your essays here. We think sometimes, okay, yeah, the serious criticism we're going to do for the fancy stuff. This is like escapist entertainment. We don't really need to engage with it that carefully. Why is it important to you that we do that?
It's important because these fandoms reflect who we are, what we believe culturally, what we believe individually. And it, you know, like people, there's a reason why people get up in arms about the representation in their fandoms, or like how things are portrayed, the politics of it. If you look at these fandoms, you can see a swath of what we believe as a culture and what we value. And I think that's really important.
I think sometimes a reaction to this kind of look is, just given the way the internet works now, is I love this thing. And if you're engaging with it and you say something bad about it, you know, we're on opposite sides. There's this like us versus them sort of thing. You clearly, in a lot of the pop culture you write about it, you might see concerns and problems. We'll talk about that. And yet you still love the thing. How can we separate out that, you know, yes or no, us against them mentality?
You know, I wish there were a better solution than, guys, you just need to chill out a little bit. Because I do get it a lot. Whenever I write an article on a beloved fandom, something that I even love, like Avatar: The Last Airbender, I wrote about that and people were upset because I was analyzing it. And I think there just needs to be a better understanding that the reason why I'm analyzing it, the reason why I'm taking the time to think through these thoughts and to, you know, go through each episode or like sit through the movies once, twice, however many times, is because I do care about this. And I do care about how this art can be improved.
We're talking to Maya Phillips. Her new book is called Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a nerd? If so, what for? Is there one particular thing you're really into? Or are you a dabbler like me, or really into a lot of different things like Maya? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You write about not just the, you know, the books and comic books themselves, but also you have an essay about fandom and how as things have gotten more mainstream, we've, I don't know, started to connect with each other and build identities in some ways around our love of nerd culture. How do we get there?
You know, it's really interesting. That's the fun thing to really see about fan culture. You know, I think it's something that we saw really early on with people who were Star Trek fans. Like they had that kind of really big community that was really active. And, you know, now we see it a lot more. I talk about people identifying with different houses in Harry Potter or different villages in Naruto. There's so many ways to relate to a fandom and like take that into real life in places where you might not feel as included as, you know, a person of color, a person with disabilities, a person, you know, of who's non-binary. That's why these fandoms are important. And, you know, it's great to see that in convention culture too, and how that's changed and how people react to gender bending, you know, doing different types of cosplay for different characters. That's really great.
You write about the treatment of race in a lot of different elements of pop culture. And there's an interesting, I think, question for people. Do we, in our science fiction or fantasy setting, do we try to, or superhero comic, do we try to talk about real world issues of race? That's one way to go. Or do we try to create a society that is outside of that, a utopia, at least when it comes to race, where we can get away from the bad stuff we have in our society? It's a tough question to answer, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
I think Black Panther is a really good example of that, that kind of addresses both sides of it. Because, you know, when we get to Black Panther, it's a very, Wakanda is very insulated. You know, they have been able to advance. They have all the technology, but they're hidden from the world. And they have this front that they're a third world country. But I think that it was really clever how the plot was created, that we have Killmonger come up as a person, as a Black American who was raised in the hood, and him coming to Wakanda and being like, you know, you guys have all these resources and you're not using it to help the other Black people across the world. So I think like that is a really good stand-in for a kind of ideological clash of what do we, especially when it comes to race and especially when it comes to like fantasy and sci-fi, all kind of genre works, like, are we actually representing an escapist fantasy where these people of color can just live freely, or do we engage with the real world, which is a part of our everyday experience?
One of my favorite elements of that you write about is time travel. When our characters go a time traveling, if our characters are white, we don't necessarily have to think about a lot. But you found some examples where Black people from the modern day went into, I don't know, Victorian England and places like that. How do you see that being handled?
You know, it's really disappointing to me because I watch time travel shows a lot. And one of my favorites is Doctor Who. And I see these characters and it's so easy to have the characters be white for that reason. Most of these characters in the time travel stories are white, or there's some kind of workaround so that they don't have to address race. But, you know, it's part of the Black experience. And if you are going to time travel, and if you're going to time travel in America, in Africa, in any of like the colonized parts of the world, that's going to be enslavement and the various indignities done to our race. That has to be part of the story. That has to be part of that character's arc. And to do that in a way that is respectful, but also makes sense to the story, it can be really difficult.
We're talking to Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you define nerd culture? Do you consider yourself a nerd about lots of things in general or something in particular? What do the things you nerd out on mean to you? Are you part of a fan community for something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maya Phillips from the New York Times about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite thing to nerd out on, call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hello. What? I'm wondering why we have to label people all the time.
As in nerd, for example, Linda?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Thanks for bringing that up, Maya. I mean, once upon a time, nerd was a negative thing that somebody called somebody who didn't want to be called that. This is one of those terms I think that's really been reclaimed. Could you talk about the label of nerd?
Sure. You know, and thanks, Linda, for your question. Yeah. I don't think labels are super important. And I think that's part of what I'm kind of poking fun at with my title. That yes, nerd used to be something you would call someone who was involved in something a little bit niche, and it was a derogatory term. And now people will say, yes, I'm kind of nerdy, or like, I love to nerd out about this. And so we see how those kinds of labels can change and how people can embrace them depending on what is happening in the zeitgeist. And I think that what's important is not the label, but just the meaning behind it. And for me, being a nerd is something I just say to let people know that I am passionate about these fandoms, and I am proud to say that I'm passionate about them.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Maya, that reminds me of your comment earlier about a lot of the things we're talking about here getting more mainstream. You talk in the book about being able to show up at a major comic book convention without a lot of advanced planning and getting tickets. Not something that could not happen today. Why do you think these elements of nerd culture became so mainstream?
I mean, it's funny because we were able to see that with Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood did pretty much all of that work. You know, you can see the shift starting with the Spider-Man movies, you know, the Sam Raimi movies. And then, of course, once the MCU got started with Iron Man, once Hollywood found out that there is an audience for this stuff and they can make these big hit action blockbusters, that they invested the money into expanding that into, and now we have all these television shows, we have all these different types of adaptations, we have, you go across every streaming service, you will find something that, you know, just a decade or two ago would have been considered a little too niche. So now it seems like people can come out into the open and say, yes, I'm very into this. And it can also invite new fans in who may not have encountered this before.
Let's go back to our callers. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I remember her referencing Doctor Who, and I have two questions. Bringing on someone of a different race and gender, what do you feel like the repercussions would be? Do you think people would be very upset about it? Me currently, I did not like the current one and the previous male. I liked everybody before that, even going all the way back. And so I'm wondering, how can I break through to that as well?
Interesting, Liz. So this is the character, the Doctor in Doctor Who, an alien who changes form to be able to change actors over time, for those not familiar with the show. And there's a woman doctor still, I believe, the concepts of changing race or gender for that character.
Yeah, I think it's really, I was really excited when Jodie Whittaker was named the next Doctor. I think she is a brilliant actress, but I think that the writing changed in such an unfortunate way that there was an increased consciousness of addressing her as a woman and addressing, you know, race in new ways, because she has, or at least in the beginning, she had these multiple companions of color. And it just became we just moved too far in the opposite direction, where it felt like wokeness for the sake of being woke. And it felt like being educational as opposed to actually, you know, thinking about the story and thinking about creating an entertaining and experience that kind of, you know, had the same kind of imagination as the previous doctors. And a lot of people blamed it and said on the doctor herself, unfortunately, saying that this is why we can't have a female doctor, but it's not that. It comes down to the writing and being more conscious of, you know, writing these stories for women or people of color. You know, the next doctor was announced and he's going to be a Black doctor. And I'm really curious to see how those writers go back and address his race and are aware of it without making it a whole big deal, because we don't want another token character. We don't want to have stories that feel tokenizing to the doctor.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Peter joins us now in Green Bay. Peter, hello.
Why, hello. Thank you for the presentation. I'm an unapologetic fan of many fandoms. I had a quick linguistic question. It may seem pedantic, but is there a difference between a geek and a nerd? Does that even matter anymore?
Peter, thanks for the call. Geek, nerd, I think that's been an argument argued many times, Maya.
Oh, yes, it has. I actually was thinking about that a lot when I was writing this book. You know, I think I don't think it matters too much. I think personally for me, I consider a nerd a person who is into some kind of fandom like I talk about, like comic books, like sci-fi, like fantasy, you know, genre, niche genre. And I consider a geek a person who is into technology, you know, like and a kind of IT person, or someone who might be kind of into gaming a lot or into computers. But that is my personal definition. I really think people use it interchangeably. People have their own personal preferences, but I don't think it's really based in anything anymore. I think just you call yourself what you call yourself. Like we said earlier, the label doesn't really matter. It just matters what your interest is.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We're talking to Maya Phillips about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. Back to your calls now with Tom on the line in Marshfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys today? I came to the Big Bang Theory about during season 3. I'd heard about it, but I'd never watched it before. And the minute I watched it, I was hooked forever. And I like the fact that they used science and humor and also had real scientists come on the show occasionally. And I was wondering what she thought about that.
Tom, thanks for the call. One of the highest profile TV depictions of nerdery, Maya.
Yes, I also was into the Big Bang Theory for quite a while. My mom still watches it when it's on reruns. And I did really enjoy it, that the references wove it into the conversations. They were pretty seamless. And my problem with the Big Bang Theory became, once I became more aware of it and once I was starting to watch it for a while, was the depiction of the male fans and the kind of misogyny that is baked into the show. And I think that is a problem in fan culture, of course. There's a lot of misogyny in fan culture. In a lot of times it won't be very inclusive of women. And I think that unfortunately, as opposed to the show reflecting that, the show also had that in its DNA. And I don't think that was fully intentional with the show. So I will still watch reruns occasionally, but I do find it kind of cringeworthy, unfortunately, sometimes, just the way that they talk about their relationships and their women. Like, these are kind of toxic guys. But as I said, I already see that enough at conventions.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Chelsea is with us in Madison. Chelsea, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've always loved reading science fiction and fantasy, and I'm very happy that in the last couple of years we've been able to have more critical conversations about how women and people of color are depicted in these stories. But I've definitely avoided rereading some of my favorites for fear that I won't enjoy them as much anymore. How do you be critical of these stories while still enjoying them?
Interesting question. Yeah.
You know, it's really tough. It can be really tough. I think that you do kind of have to put your critical side to the side. If you can, like, if you really want to enjoy these things that cause, you know, that give you the sense of nostalgia that you enjoyed as a kid, that you know are problematic, I think you can have a moment where you say, okay, I know this is not great for this reason, but you can still move on and like go, you can reread it or you can rewatch it. And I think as long as you have that awareness, then that's fine. Like, these are all personal interests. These are all personal loves. And so no one will judge you sitting in your house watching something that you loved when you were a kid. No one's going to do that. I think it becomes a problem when we give more money to things that are problematic, when we engage in a public forum with things that are problematic without actually signaling that, you know, this is the problem with this. This is the problem with that. So as I said, enjoy what you're going to enjoy. And, you know, just keep it in mind that some of these things don't age well. And that's just the nature of everything. Even things today that are really popular, we'll find something that's wrong with them in the future. That's how it goes.
Thanks for that call, Chelsea. And Maya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Maya Phillips from the New York Times talking about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@WPR.org. Regular listeners may have noticed that I was off for a few days there, thanks to Lee Rayburn for filling in. I was on a fun little trip to New Orleans, and I learned something. I always thought Mardi Gras was just like that one day, but no, it's Mardi Gras season from January 6th to Fat Tuesday. So I got to see a couple of parades, one smaller one I just ran into. The theme was a bunch of guys wearing beads and hats, as far as I could tell. But then there was a big one that I made a point of seeing called Chewbacca's, with lots of crews based on Star Wars and other science fiction. It all made me think we could do the same thing here in Wisconsin. We like to celebrate. Parades and costumes are fun. Just one hurdle. When I saw those parades at night in New Orleans, it was like 60-some degrees there. I looked at the temperatures back home here in Wisconsin. Low single digits and some negatives, too. So maybe there is a reason it all happens in New Orleans, but not here. Letting the good times and low temperatures roll, this is Central Time.